Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Yen. I'm the LACNETS Director of Programs and Outreach, as well as a caregiver and advocate for my husband who is living with NET. In each podcast episode, we talk to a NET expert who answers your top 10 questions. This podcast is for educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Please discuss your questions and concerns with your physician.
Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm really excited today to introduce our special guest, Dr. Nitya Raj. Dr. Raj is a gastrointestinal medical oncologist from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City with a clinical practice devoted to caring for people with gastrointestinal and endocrine cancers, including neuroendocrine cancers. Her research also focuses on advancing treatments for neuroendocrine cancers. Dr. Raj is studying ways to improve our understanding of how neuroendocrine cancers change at a genetic level over time and as a result of different treatments in order to better personalize our care for people with those cancers. Dr. Raj's work has been recognized and supported by the American Society for Clinical Oncology with a Young Investigators Award and a Career Development Award. Both are prestigious awards, and she has also been awarded with a pilot award in 2017 by the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. Nationally, Dr. Raj serves on the Neuroendocrine Tumor Task Force of the National Cancer Institute, and she is one of the authors of the recently published Expert Consensus Practice Recommendations of the North American Neuroendocrine Tumor Society for the Management of High-Grade Gastroenteropancreatic and Gynecologic Neuroendocrine Neoplasms. Dr. Raj, your peers speak highly of you as someone who is an expert in high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas, and I'm really excited to have you here today with us. And just want to share one fun fact that Dr. Raj is a mother of three young girls and an avid tennis player. So welcome to today's podcast. And if you will, share a little bit about how you got involved in the neuroendocrine cancer community.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me today. You know, I kind of fell into the neuroendocrine world when I was a medical oncology fellow at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And so during my second year of fellowship, I joined the GI oncology group, and I did my research and my clinical focus in GI oncology with a special focus in neuroendocrine cancers. And through those experiences, just learned a lot, really loved caring for patients with this very heterogeneous disease, and had the opportunity after I finished up my fellowship to stay on faculty. And I've really invested my career thus far as an oncologist in caring for people with neuroendocrine cancers and trying to advance our therapies for these diseases.
We're really grateful that you got interested in it early on, with research, and you're continuing that research and that interest.
Absolutely.
Well, you know the topic that we're talking about today, high-grade neuroendocrine cancer, specifically grade 3 poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, or NEC for short. But I just wanted to give a background of why we're doing this topic. In general, some of our educational conferences and content, we tend to be lumpers. We lump everything together and have educational content on neuroendocrine neoplasms, neuroendocrine cancers overall. But as you and I know, there are differences in the types of neuroendocrine neoplasms. And so we want to separate them out and be splitters. So for today, we're going to concentrate just on the grade 3 poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, or NEC for short. So with that, let's jump into the first question and define what this is, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sounds perfect. I think that's a great way to start. So poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, which I'll refer to as NEC for the rest of the questions, just to make things a little bit easier, are what we think of as the most aggressive subtype of neuroendocrine cancers or neuroendocrine neoplasms. So we as oncologists do recognize that this is generally the most aggressive type of neuroendocrine cancer that we're going to care for. We come to the diagnosis of a NEC really through the pathology, which is after someone has been defined to have a cancer and then undergoes either a biopsy or surgery, their tissue is looked at under the microscope. And we use a special classification schema, which divides neuroendocrine cancers either into the well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors or the poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas. There are a few specific subtypes of poorly differentiated NEC. There are small cell carcinomas, large cell carcinoma, non-small cell carcinomas, and then something called mixed neuroendocrine carcinomas, but all of them fall under the NEC bucket. But I think it's important for us to emphasize that all necks are poorly differentiated and vice versa. But the trickiest thing with neuroendocrine cancers, which is also true of the neuroendocrine carcinomas, is that they can really arise anywhere in the body. So the prototypical neck is what we call small cell lung cancer, which is a neck that originates from the lung. And so if you Google neck, that's often what will come up. And small cell lung cancer is 95% of all small cell carcinomas. But I think it's very important to recognize, and what there's not as much literature on, although there's a growing body of literature out there, are what we call our extrapulmonary, or those cancers that start outside of the lung. So extrapulmonary, poorly differentiated necks. And most often those will arise in the gastrointestinal tract and are cared for us as GI oncologists. So we can see necks arise from the colon, from the rectum, from the esophagus, from the stomach, from the pancreas, from the anal canal. But we can also see necks arise from other sites, including the prostate or the bladder or even the gynecologic organs. And there's even a small subgroup of necks, about a third of necks, that are considered to be unknown primary. So we actually aren't able to necessarily define where that cancer originated. So that's one of the biggest challenges with necks versus the well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. There's so much heterogeneity in where these cancers originated, and a lot of the studies that have been done are likely lumping many diseases together. So our management for this disease is often based on expert opinion, given some of the paucity of the data that's out there, which is really a big challenge and hurdle in studying this disease that we're working together to try to improve for future investigation.
Wow, what an excellent overview explaining the terms and the understanding of it. So you said that it could be really found whether in the lung or outside the lung, and most often in the GI tract. How are these necks found, and how do people then know that they have a neck?
The diagnosis and presenting symptoms of neck, I would actually say, is relatively similar to symptoms that people can present with when they're diagnosed with any type of solid tumor. And so sometimes people will present with vague GI complaints like abdominal pain or nausea or vomiting that's just kind of progressively getting worse. Sometimes people may just present with very generalized symptoms like progressive fatigue and weight loss that then prompts a workup and ultimately leads to the diagnosis. You know, one of the common areas that this cancer can sometimes go to is the liver. And sometimes, because this cancer can grow very, very quickly, you know, it could start to affect the liver function. I would say it's more rare, but sometimes we'll see people present with abnormal liver function tests or even symptoms of what we call jaundice. So there's not just classic symptoms that someone with a neck will present with, but I would say more broad symptoms that we can see across the spectrum of cancers. And so those symptoms will generally prompt further workup from the provider. And then that will ultimately lead to either a biopsy or a surgery that will then cinch the diagnosis of a neck.
Yeah, that's really helpful to understand that. You mentioned that sometimes you can't find the primary site. And I was wondering, how important is it, if at all, to find that?
I think that's a great question. And like I had mentioned, in about a third of cases, we won't be able to define the primary site. I mean, of course, ideally, it's helpful to know where the cancer originated because that can help you strategize your treatment plan. That being said, for necks, this is probably the one disease where your first choice of treatments is typically not defined by the site of origin. So sometimes when I meet patients in clinic and we have that conversation that we're not sure where that cancer originated, I do emphasize that, yes, you know, we're going to work to do additional tests to see if we can try to sort this out. We may not be able to, but that lack of knowing where the cancer started is not going to impact my first choice in how we should treat your cancer.
Yeah, so you can go ahead and move forward without knowing all of the unknowns. And one other follow-up question, you mentioned a lot of times the cancer has spread to the liver, which many of us are aware of. So I think a common thing that comes up is, how do we then define this, especially if there's an unknown primary? Is this considered liver cancer? What do we call this?
I think in general, the way that we will refer to these necks that we're uncertain where the cancer originated, but that they involve the liver, is that these are poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas of unknown primary with liver involvement. So it's well appreciated that it's very, very unlikely that the site of origin is the liver itself. But that site of origin just might be so microscopic that our tools are not good enough for us to identify it. You know, the one point that I would want to make, though, is that the landscape is changing in terms of the tools that we have. And so genetic testing is something that we're starting to do more commonly on biopsies or other tumor samples. And sometimes the results from that can shed some light to us on potential sites of tumor origin, because we do appreciate that some of the genetic changes in neuroendocrine carcinomas can be shared with genetic changes that we may see in more common types of cancers that may originate in certain parts of the body. And so that's something that I think all of us try to do when possible. And if there's enough tissue, or if not, there's also new panels that we can do in the blood to try to give us more clues as to where the cancer may have originated.
So hopefully with more tools, there can be more clarity and more information and a better understanding.
Exactly.
And thank you for your work in this area as well. So you've already started to mention how neck is different from other types of neuroendocrine cancers. How else is it unique? And in particular, how is it different compared to grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors? Again, we talk about lumping. Sometimes high grades in general are lumped together.
So I think that's a really great question. What I'd like to do is step back for a minute and just walk everyone through the pathologic classification for neuroendocrine neoplasms, because it's really important for us as providers, but also our patients, to understand exactly what cancer we're dealing with when someone gets a diagnosis of a neuroendocrine cancer. So this is all defined by something called the World Health Organization. And there were more recent updates in the past several years that have now recognized, as you mentioned, Lisa, a what we call well-differentiated high-grade neuroendocrine tumor category, and then a poorly differentiated neck category. And those are two true different categories of neuroendocrine cancers. And this is based on two features that our pathologists help us with. And so when they're looking at tumor under the microscope, they're first looking to see what the differentiation of the cancer is. Do those cancer cells look more healthy appearing? That is typically what we see in a well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. And then the second part of that is if those cancer cells look more immature or they're dividing more quickly, and that typically is more what a poorly differentiated neck looks like under the microscope. So that's the differentiation status. And then the next thing they're looking at is how quickly are those cancer cells dividing, and they can give us specific percentages. And so a well-differentiated high-grade neuroendocrine tumor is typically dividing at a rate of greater than 20%, but those cancer cells look well differentiated under the microscope. Whereas a poorly differentiated neck also is high grade in that those cancer cells are dividing at a rate of higher than 20%, but those cells truly look different under the microscope. They're more immature looking in appearance. And classically, the poorly differentiated necks are dividing at even a higher rate, usually above 50%. Sometimes there's a little bit of a gray zone there, and we have to use the tools from the pathologist along with how someone's presenting, as well as maybe even the genetics, to help us clarify things. But generally, that's how I would break apart well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors that are high grade and then poorly differentiated neck.
That's a really helpful overview and understanding of how they all fall in line with the classifications. So understanding that there is a difference between the grade 3 well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor and the neck, can a NET, the well-differentiated, change to a neck? And if so, what's the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah, so rarely we can see well-differentiated NETs become NECs. Now, there's a lot of work that's gone into this, and this has been a huge focus of our work even, and in my research, where we can see that well-differentiated NETs can change over time and over therapy. And what we most commonly see is that you may have well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors that are lower grade, then maybe over time have some areas of the cancer that are intermediate grade or maybe high grade. Rarely, yes, you can see a true transformation where a well-differentiated NET becomes a poorly differentiated neck. But I would say generally that's a less common path of transformation. So the likelihood of that happening is actually very low. We generally think of the well-differentiated net and the poorly differentiated neck as really truly two different diseases. And I would actually say that more commonly, we think of there actually being a relationship between poorly differentiated necks and non-neck tumors of the same site that have transformed. So for instance, an adenocarcinoma that has then transformed into a neck. That's the more common thought process of how necks can develop and evolve over time. And you can even see that with the genetics and coming back to the fact that an adenocarcinoma of the colon has things common genetically with necks of the colon. And so we actually more commonly think of necks and non-necks of the same site to probably have a pathway of transformation rather than cancers going truly from being a well-differentiated net to a poorly differentiated neck.
That's a really helpful distinction. And what you just said, like they're almost completely different diseases. And even when we think of neuroendocrine cancers, I mean, we talk about the zebras, they're completely different, but they're not even that similar to a well-differentiated grade 3 NET.
Correct. And just to kind of tag team off of your question, you know, we think of them as different diseases. Under the microscope, they look like different diseases. And then our treatment approaches and paradigms are different for the two. So the treatment for well-differentiated NET is very different than the treatment for poorly differentiated neck. And it reflects the fact that generally this is not just one pathway where the cancer is going from well-differentiated low grade to intermediate grade to high grade and then a poorly differentiated neck. That's not what happens. These are really two different diseases.
So how would your approach be different with a neck?
So as I was explaining, you know, necks are a more aggressive disease in that they grow a lot more quickly. They divide a lot more quickly. And so the mainstay of therapy for necks is chemotherapy. And so that's very, very different than your well-differentiated NET. But we think of our chemotherapy drugs as our best tools to treat necks. And we can get beautiful responses to the chemotherapy. So it just reflects that much quicker growing nature and cell turnover that we're seeing with necks.
So because they're aggressive, you have to take a more aggressive approach. Yeah. Well, you did mention genetic testing as something that's being done. What other types of labs, scans, or testing is done for necks?
When you meet someone who's been diagnosed with a neck and you're thinking through how to do further testing or what testing is needed to formulate your treatment plan, in terms of blood work, you want basic blood work to just get a sense of what someone's blood counts are, what their liver function is, what their kidney function is. There actually aren't special kind of blood-based biomarkers that we check in the blood for poorly differentiated necks. And there's not a special sort of blood test that we can use to track the disease over time. So with your blood work, you're looking to see what the function is of someone's organs because that's going to help you decide what are the right chemotherapy tools to treat the cancer. So in terms of blood tests, really, I'm checking more standard blood tests. When it comes to imaging, and I think this is the case for all neuroendocrine neoplasms, but what is very important is really, really good quality cross-sectional imaging. So you want a really, really good quality, either CAT scan or MRI that's going to take a good look at the chest, the abdomen, the pelvis, to really clearly define to you where the cancer is located, what the size is of the tumors that we're dealing with, and just what the extent of the disease is. I think one of the questions that comes up often is something called functional scans. And that's when we're talking about our PETs and what are our best tools there. And I would say that it's still a mix from person to person, how they're using their functional imaging. One thing that is not standard in this disease is we typically don't check the gallium scan. So the gallium dotatate is a special type of PET scan that's looking for the somatostatin receptor that we can see overexpressed in a lot of well-differentiated NETs. But those therapies that target that receptor are not therapies that we use for poorly differentiated NECs. And so the dotatate PET scan typically doesn't have a role when you're trying to work up a poorly differentiated neck. That being said, there's another type of PET scan that we will sometimes use, which is called an FDG PET. And so that's your more classic PET scan that's looking for the uptake of glucose and how quickly the cells are dividing. And sometimes you could see a lot of uptake on FDG PETs with poorly differentiated necks. That being said, that's not a test that I always do standard in this disease. I think you always have to be thoughtful about how many tests you're ordering and what value they're going to be adding to your management plan. And for me, the most important thing is to first have very, very good quality cross-sectional imaging. If there are still questions or I'm trying to sort out whether something may or may not be disease related, then sometimes I might use that FDG PET, but it's definitely not my first choice in terms of the radiology imaging. So those would be the types of labs and scans that I would do when I'm doing a workup after someone gets a diagnosis of a poorly differentiated neck.
Dr. Raj, you mentioned really good cross-sectional imaging. What makes a scan a really good image?
I think that generally we're very fortunate in the U.S. that we have access to really excellent imaging across the country. And so generally, any CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, or CAT scan of the chest with an MRI of the abdomen and pelvis is going to be sufficient here. Most of the cuts now on CAT scans are tighter, and so you get really, really accurate measurements of the disease. But the flip side is the MRIs can be very useful in that they're less radiation exposure to patients. We can use them more safely if someone has issues with their kidney function. So it's all individualized depending on what someone's other health issues may be in terms of what you decide to use. But I think either or is reasonable.
And what is the role? You mentioned genetic testing. What is the role of genetic testing?
And then also, what about genomic testing?
So I will say, I think the role for genetic testing right now is mixed. And so when you look at the national guidelines, it's not required that you're doing genetic testing for every neck diagnosis. That being said, in the era of cancer therapies now being more genomically driven, it can be very valuable to see if there's any specific targets. And so there's two types of genetic testing we can do. There's testing in the tumor itself, where you're looking to see what genes are changed in the tumor. And that can definitely open up or potentially impact treatments. And so I think that is something that I try to do with anyone who has a diagnosis of neck. And then the second part of genetic testing is what we call germline testing, where you're looking in the blood to see if there's potentially anything familial or that could have increased an individual's risk for a neck. There aren't really germline genetic syndromes that have been associated with this disease. So that's not necessarily standard practice to do. I will say more and more genetic testing is sort of becoming bundled, that you can do both types of testing at once. And we're beginning to appreciate with kind of advances in the technology, we may be able to pick up more than we used to. So I do try to do both if I can. But if we run into any issues with access to tissue quality right now, we may get a little bit more limited. I would want to say that it's not necessarily standard, but I think it can be valuable additional information to have.
Yeah. Thank you for this. So a really nice understanding of the blood work, scans, and then other testing that needs to be done. So after all this information is collected, then people start wondering, well, what do treatments look like for me? And one of the first questions is surgery. Can a neck be surgically removed? And how do you decide if, when, and how?
Yeah, and I think this is a really great question. And as you said, it's often the first question that someone asks me when I meet them in clinic and they've received this diagnosis. Now, as I had mentioned, the challenge with necks is, at least historically, the diagnosis has carried what we would call a more aggressive course or a poorer prognosis. So in the studies that have been done, even in people who present with a neck that we think is localized and is just limited to one spot, often we think of survival on the order of a little bit over a year. So this has always begged the question of what's the role of surgery in this disease? Because even when you think you're catching the cancer early, if we still aren't able to cure it and survival remains shorter, are we doing the right thing by doing surgery? Because we get concerned about what we call the disease we can't see, or that microscopic disease. And we know that risk of microscopic disease is just so high for necks. And so the tricky thing is when these cancers present localized, rarely do we have a preoperative diagnosis. So someone may present with a mass in their pancreas and may very quickly go to surgery first, actually, before the pathology is defined. And so then you actually get the diagnosis of a neck after the surgery has been done. And that's okay. And we appreciating the chance of there being microscopic cancer cells there, we are very quick to say it's going to be very important that chemotherapy is part of your treatment plan, and we're going to try to clean up any cancer cells that could have been left behind. And so that is often when you see surgery come into play more quickly in this disease, when perhaps there isn't a preoperative diagnosis and you actually find out about the diagnosis of neck after the surgery. And the reason I bring that up is because if you do happen to know the diagnosis ahead of time, like if you get a biopsy first and the biopsy shows poorly differentiated neck and it is localized, then this is a disease where multidisciplinary discussion is actually really essential and really, really important. And so there's an opportunity sometimes to consider chemotherapy first in that situation and try to hit those microscopic cells earlier, but also treat the cancer you can see, or what we call the macroscopic disease. And then sometimes rather than the surgery, we think about maybe even using radiation therapy as our tool to treat that localized disease. And the reason why I bring that up is because some of these surgical procedures that we do, like if the cancer is in the rectum or in the anus or in the pancreas, these can be surgeries that are huge, can impact quality significantly, and the recovery time can be very, very long. That recovery time could potentially delay offering chemotherapy, which we know is really, really important here. And so it can sort of change our strategy. Sometimes we might favor actually giving chemotherapy followed by radiation therapy for localized tumors versus surgery first. But again, it's multidisciplinary discussion. And so for localized necks, there's no standard in terms of surgery or not, although more and more of us appreciate how important the chemotherapy is and getting the chemotherapy in early. And so sometimes we are considering other alternatives to surgery. Now, I think that for more advanced necks, those that perhaps started in one part of the body and then we know have spread to another part of the body, generally, given the more aggressive nature of the disease, there really isn't any role for surgery or for debulking. Sometimes people will ask me, could we go in and at least just remove what we can see? And the challenge in that situation is that while the surgeon may be able to technically do that, this is a disease that can grow so quickly that even just during the short period of time that you're recovering from the debulking surgery, the cancer is going to pop up again. And so we haven't put ourselves in a better position to treat the disease and haven't really reset the clock. And in fact, we may be hurting someone more because we may not be able to treat that disease when it comes back because they may be recovering from a big procedure. So for more advanced neck, unfortunately, right now, there isn't a role for surgery.
Yeah, I hear the clear message. Surgery isn't a big player in this, and it's more chemotherapy. I guess let's talk about how is neck treated non-surgically. When you talk about chemo, what kind of chemo agents? And then also, what about liver-directed therapies and other types of therapies?
That's a great question. So like we've been talking about, the mainstay of therapy for necks is really chemotherapy. And our use of chemotherapy in this disease is actually largely based on retrospective data. So meaning not clinical trials that we've conducted and then looked at the efficacy of therapies, but actually looking back at how patients with the disease have responded to various chemotherapy regimens, but also from extrapolation of clinical trials that have been done in small cell lung cancer, which I had mentioned is the most common neck that we see in clinical practice. And so the expert consensus is for prompt initiation of chemotherapy comprised of two drugs as our first choice. And one drug is called a platinum drug, and we commonly use either cisplatin or carboplatin. And then the second drug is a drug called etoposide. And so platinum etoposide, sometimes abbreviated as EP, is what you will see most commonly used in this disease, irrespective of where it started. And so that's why I said earlier, while ideally we would love to know the site of origin, ultimately, if we have the diagnosis of a neck, even if we don't know where that cancer started, we're usually going to be recommending platinum etoposide chemotherapy. And I think that the silver lining here, appreciating that, yes, we're dealing with a more aggressive disease that can grow quickly, is that the majority of necks will respond to platinum etoposide chemotherapy. And so we can see very, very beautiful responses to this chemo. We can very quickly see symptoms improve, which is really, really important, right, in terms of maximizing quality. The tricky thing is that we don't have a great way to predict the duration of the response. And so it's kind of all over the place. Sometimes we can get a very, very long period of disease control, and other times we can get a beautiful response. But then if we take a little bit of a break off of the chemotherapy, the cancer can start growing again. So platinum etoposide is really what we think of as our best choice or our ideal choice that we would like to be able to try when someone has a diagnosis of a neck.
Yeah. And how long would you treat with, and what would you do if there was later on progression?
So I would typically extrapolate from the way small cell lung cancers are treated. And usually we will plan to give 6 to 8 cycles of the platinum etoposide initially. You know, I'm assessing patients every few weeks and just seeing how they're doing cycle by cycle. And depending on how they're doing, we'll decide whether or not we take a break after 6 cycles if some of the side effects are picking up, or sometimes we'll push to 8 cycles if someone is feeling really well. But then typically I would take a break after that and monitor the disease closely with scans and clinical visits every few months. And the decision of what to do next depends a little bit on when the cancer starts to grow again. And so if there's been a long period of time before we see growth, like I usually say 6+ months, just because we have a lot of other good tools to use to treat this cancer, then I might do a second course of the platinum etoposide before going to another type of treatment. But if the cancer comes back quicker, then we might choose to move to a different type of chemotherapy sooner. And so when we think about what's our next choice, it's often based on where the cancer started. And so that's why ideally knowing the site of origin can be helpful, because if we know that the cancer started in the GI tract, then we may think about using chemotherapies with a drug called 5-FU, which can be very, very effective across a spectrum of necks starting in the GI tract. Sometimes we will use temozolomide, which is a common chemotherapy drug that's actually used in well-differentiated nets. But there's data to support its use in poorly differentiated neck too. The challenge is that the data that's out there with the temozolomide, we know that generally the response rates are poorer for the poorly differentiated neck compared to the well-differentiated nets, and the time to treatment failure can be quicker. So it's a chemotherapy drug that I'll consider, but if I know where the cancer is originating, I'll try to pivot to a chemotherapy regimen that may be more commonly used for other types of pancreas cancer or colon cancer, for instance, or whatnot. So chemotherapy after platinum etoposide tends to become site of origin specific. Now, I know you had asked about liver-directed therapies, and do liver-directed therapies have a role in neck? Now, similar to well-differentiated nets, the most common site that necks go to is the liver. The challenge is that the tumors of neck that's in the liver don't have the features of NET in the liver that we'll often take advantage of for liver-directed therapies. And so generally, for necks, it's not a disease where we will typically use liver-directed therapies. So again, comes back to the fact that this is truly a different disease.
So chemotherapy, again, is the mainstay here.
Chemotherapy is the mainstay. The one thing that is up and coming and we're learning more about in this disease is immunotherapy and how may that play into the mix in terms of treating this disease. And there's been a lot of work that's been done in recent years as we've had more access to different types of immunotherapy drugs. And I think one of the challenges in most of the studies that have been done is that we lumped the well-differentiated nets and the poorly differentiated necks together. So it's been hard to see if there's a signal within a specific subgroup. But the data that we have right now supports that possibly if you're going to use immunotherapy, there's probably a benefit to using 2 immunotherapy drugs together to treat the poorly differentiated necks. So blocking the immune system in 2 different ways. And so I do consider immunotherapy, and it is a treatment that I will sometimes use for poorly differentiated necks. I don't typically use it first. I will usually try platinum etoposide first and then often site of origin specific chemotherapies, but I'll definitely consider immunotherapy as an option. And so I do think there's a role for immunotherapy in the disease. If the genetic testing reveals specific changes that may make the cancer more amenable, or you may think immunotherapy may work better, like there's a higher tumor mutation burden or it's microsatellite unstable, then absolutely immunotherapy will move up higher into the treatment strategy.
And with immunotherapy, does it need to be done in a clinical trial? Are you able to just prescribe immunotherapy?
So generally now, I think one of the really wonderful things is in the national cancer guidelines, immunotherapy is listed as an option for higher grade neuroendocrine cancers based on the data that's out there. And so we generally are able to get immunotherapy drugs approved off of clinical trial. Now, that being said, and there have been some very good clinical trials that have been done. There are some that are ongoing now. And if they think that there's a good clinical trial ongoing, then we should absolutely go on to that study, because we're getting smarter at the way that we develop these studies. And we are really trying to subgroup neuroendocrine cancers. And this is how we're going to learn and be able to improve on our therapies for neck in specific. But we don't have access to the right clinical trial, and we think immunotherapy might be the right option as the next step. We have access to those drugs typically off of a clinical trial.
That's reassuring, especially for those who can't necessarily get to a center that offers them.
Absolutely.
So speaking of clinical trials, and we know you're involved in clinical research and trials, what are clinical trials we should be aware of? What are ones that you in particular are excited about?
Yeah, so I think that there's a few good things going on in the neck space. And probably one of the trickiest things about necks that start outside of the lung is that we're using the data from the necks that start from the lung. And so one of the therapies that's actually now approved for like small cell lung cancer in your first line is to give the chemotherapy. So to give the platinum and the etoposide drugs in combination with immunotherapy. But the data hasn't played out as well for necks that start outside of the lung. And so one of the questions I commonly get is, should we be using chemotherapy in combination with immunotherapy just as our first choice to treat this cancer? And unfortunately, there have been some studies that have been done, and we actually did a study with a few other big neuroendocrine centers recently, which was a really wonderful collaborative effort where we didn't see activity, at least in more advanced and previously treated necks for chemotherapy in combination with immunotherapy. But the reason why I bring this up is because there's a really important, what we call cooperative group study led by a group called SWOG that's looking at platinum chemotherapy with etoposide chemotherapy in combination with a drug called atezolizumab. And so that's actually standard of care treatment for small cell lung cancer, but it's not standard of care treatment for necks that start outside of the lung. And so that is definitely my plug for, I think, one of the most important studies that's going on right now. And so that's for newly diagnosed necks, so not received any therapy. The computer decides whether you're going to get the chemotherapy in combination with the immunotherapy, or you're going to get the chemotherapy alone. And the other thing that study is looking at is something called maintenance immunotherapy. So after you get a period of time on the chemotherapy with the immunotherapy, is there a role for continuing the immunotherapy drug alone? And so that study is active, it's open, it's accruing around the country, and I think it's a very, very important study. So I think that's probably the largest study that's going on right now for next, and a very important one that's going to answer a very important question for us. And I think some of the other work that's going on is a little bit earlier. It's not as far along in terms of what phase the studies are at, but there's a lot of earlier phase studies looking at other targets that we might be able to take advantage of in next. And I think probably the most exciting target that's being studied is something called delta-like ligand 3, or DLL3. So DLL3 is a protein that's part of what we call the Notch pathway, which is a type of cell signaling pathway. So a pathway that we think may be abnormal for some reason in cancers. And there's data to tell us that in necks, that's a pathway that cannot be working properly, and that there can be overexpression of this DLL3 protein. And that overexpression can actually be associated with poorer clinical outcomes in necks. And so there's a lot of work that's been done in targeting DLL3 in small cell lung cancer, which has been very, very promising. And so now there's more work going into targeting DLL3 in necks that started outside of the lung. And so those are earlier clinical trials, but it's looking at targeting DLL3 in a lot of different ways. And I think those are really, really interesting studies to consider. So I think that for neck, a clinical trial at any point in your decision tree is really, really important, because there aren't a lot of clinical trials ongoing. And so there's a good clinical trial with a potentially a good target and someone's a candidate for the study, I always advocate for us to consider the study, as long as we can ensure that we're not compromising someone's quality while they're on therapy, because I think that's really, really important too. But I would say those are the most exciting areas right now of research for next in terms of clinical trials.
Thank you for sharing that clinical trial, and we'll have that information for that SWOG 2012 study on our podcast page as well. So after you started treatment for someone with a neck, how would you monitor them? What types of blood work, tests, or scans, and how often would that need to be done?
So after someone gets started on therapy, whatever type of therapy that is, whether it's chemotherapy or immunotherapy, some of the treatments that we've talked about, I am typically checking routine blood work. So blood counts, liver function, kidney function, every time I see them before their next chemotherapy cycle or sooner, if there's some concerning symptoms or we're a little worried that something may be going on. And so routine blood work, like I said, there isn't any special blood to be tracking or like a cancer marker to be tracking and following for this diagnosis. So I'm checking routine blood work. And then I'm typically doing scans every 2 to 3 months. And again, I usually rely on my CAT scan or my MRI, unless for some reason or the other, there was a reason why we preferentially thought the FDG PET was a better way to monitor the disease. But typically, I think the CAT scans or the MRIs give us our best information in terms of how the cancer is responding. So CAT scans or MRIs are usually every 2 to 3 months. Now, if symptoms are getting worse for some reason, or we see some changes in the lab work that are concerning to us, then I will, of course, check a scan sooner. But those are our best tools to monitor the disease during therapy and even on treatment breaks.
Yeah, so back to the cross-sectional imaging and blood work. So we'll end with this last question. I mean, this is a very challenging disease, and there's a lot of unknowns, as you mentioned, even knowing where the primary site is for a third of patients. And there's a lot of unknown in terms of what treatments work best. So it can be really hard coming in as someone diagnosed with it or a family member. It can be hard to be hopeful. And what words of hope would you like to share with those who are living with neuroendocrine carcinomas?
You know, I'm glad that we're spending a few minutes and ending with this topic because I totally agree. It can be very hard to receive the diagnosis of a neuroendocrine carcinoma. And it can be very confusing too, because sometimes the terms are mixed up and then you start reading about it and you're confused. Do I have a NET? Do I have a NEC? What are we dealing with here? And it can be very overwhelming to parse apart the pathology and the available data that's out there. So I agree, it's a very challenging diagnosis to receive, and it can be hard to appreciate what our limitations are in 2023 right now in terms of the types of therapies we have, and that really our best tools are chemotherapy drugs. Now, that being said, I would say that we, as those who care for neuroendocrine cancers and are really invested in moving the field forward, are very, very, very invested in collaborative efforts here because we know that this is a rare disease. Our studies are lumping a lot of different necks together, and we know that the only way that we're going to move the field forward is through collaboration and conducting studies together and even looking at our data together in patients with necks that we've treated. And so I would want to let the community know that we are well aware of this and we are working together. And that's very, very important to us. And so, like I had mentioned, just to highlight recently, even I myself had the opportunity to do a clinical trial with two other institutions focused purely on poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. And that was a study that included almost 40 patients that we were able to do very quickly because we had three centers working together. And yes, while it ultimately wasn't a positive study, you could see the benefits of collaboration in terms of successfully answering a question, an important question for this disease. And so I think that's how we are approaching it as clinicians and researchers in this field. And I think that our advancing understanding of neck genetics is allowing us to parse apart these cancers more. And I think that we are together as a community brainstorming and work a lot of ideas in terms of evaluating therapy response based on genetics, based on specific subclassifications in the pathology, whether it's small cell or a large cell or a mixed tumor. And that is some of how we're trying to improve on treatment immediately. There's a lot of energy going into advancing treatment for NECs, and there's a lot of important earlier clinical trials, earlier phase clinical trials ongoing, but also the SWOG study. So a larger phase 2, phase 3 studies. And so I would want to make sure people are aware that we're very invested in doing research and next in trying to subclassify the disease better in the studies that we conduct so that hopefully we can truly make improvements in our therapies in the near future.
It's hopeful and it's almost a relief to hear that there are people working on our behalf that are so committed and working together, because there's a sense of the teamwork makes us stronger together. Thank you so much for that dedication, that hard work. We know that that's a lot. That's a lot of personal and professional investment. And it takes special people like you to do this work. And I hope that together we continue to move the field forward and provide more options, more hope, better quality of life for those living with NIC.
Of course, it's my honor. It's our honor, I think, as providers in the neuroendocrine world.
Thank you so much for joining us today and for providing this information, knowledge, and hope. We look forward to seeing you again in the future.
Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for listening to the LACNETS podcast. Go to our website, lacnets.org/podcast, for episode transcripts and resources. We want to thank our podcast supporters, Ipsen, ITM, Advanced Accelerator Applications, Tercera Therapeutics, and Lantheus. For more information about neuroendocrine cancer, go to www.lacnets.org. LACNETS depends on donations to bring you programs such as this podcast. Please consider making a donation at lacnets.org/donate.